You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine on Sunday, August 20th, 2023. I'll begin with a featured story from the Times. Jean-Paul is still busy. For more than 20 years, he's taught generations to let loose on the dance floor. He's not stopping anytime soon. This is a story by Iva Dixit. The song is a giddy exaltation of oscillating hips in full swing, of beautiful backsides and the beautiful forms they belong to as they get jiggy, get crunked up, percolate. It's a knight's declaration of courtly love to his five fair ladies, Jody, Rebecca, Annabella, the Mrs. Donna, and Canna. It's a lover's sincere exhortation to his beloved to shake that thing, made with a sly exuberance that is both worshipful and raunchy. This is the seminal dance hall classic Get Busy, a 21-year-old party anthem that has been the source of dance floor awakenings for generations of horny teenagers and young adults. And the knight paying homage to the things he is so respectfully asking the ladies to shake is Jean-Paul, arguably Jamaica's most famous musical export to the United States since Bob Marley. Two decades ago, after dethroning 50 Cent and Da Club from its number one spot on Billboard's Hot 100 chart, Get Busy did for Jean-Paul what Taxi Driver did for Paul Schrader and Liebenstrommen No. 3 did for Franz Liszt. This was the work that made an instant legend of its creator, who until then had been only a moderately successful purveyor of dancehall, Jamaica's musical successor to reggae. Young people today seem to be discovering Jean-Paul with the same delight their elders once did in middle school. On TikTok, the barometer of all contemporary youth relevance, influencers like Charli D'Amelio and Addison Rae, who were un or barely born in 2003, can be found participating in viral dance challenges to Get Busy, while millennial comedians 10 years their senior make videos about the unfairness of being in seventh grade when the song was ruling clubs. Like low-rise jeans, going out tops in the Fast and Furious franchise, Jean-Paul is one of those ubiquitous elements of Y2K-era American life that has experienced a thundering resurgence. I sat down with Paul on a salubrious June afternoon. Salubrious was his choice of word, on Hellshire Beach near Kingston, where sargassum clogs the shoreline and clusters of shacks jostle for limited space on the ever-shrinking sands. At one of these establishments, either Screechies or Screechies, depending on whether you believe the indoor spelling or the outdoor one, covers were removed from platters of fried red snappers. Paul, wearing bright orange cargo shorts and a t-shirt emblazoned with the word Duddy, unrolled his smoking paraphernalia. He was by turns sprightly and pensive. The party boy persona that once made him a megastar has evolved into that of a fun but responsible uncle, the one who still knows how to throw a party, but will also ensure that everyone eats well and gets home safely afterward. The night before, for instance, in the courtyard of a studio I was told had been built by Shaggy and his former manager, I watched some of Paul's associates smoke from a many feet long chalice pipe as they waited to begin rehearsals for a coming tour. When Paul drove up, he announced he had brought a case of mangoes from his own orchard, and I was treated to the wholesome tableau of a group of grown men tearing into a cardboard box, each extracting a mango and biting in with sighs and groans of unadulterated relish. The rehearsal featured breaks to crack open bottles of industrial strength white rum and loud shouts of laughter, including at my saying I shouldn't drink while working, and at my frozen expression when I did finally try a sip. This jovial gathering of dad bods, dad shorts and dad jokes more resembled the vibe of an after-school band rehearsal than a multi-platinum recording artist preparing to play a sold-out arena. Perhaps because some of these guys really have known Paul since his earliest days in music. As Paul explained to me at Screechy's, for his life to become what it is now, that of a Grammy-winning artist with YouTube views in the multiple billions and a catalog of beloved classics, a series of extremely fortunate events had to occur, and a fair number of them he didn't have much say in. Long before he became the bandanaed and cornrowed Jean-Paul who entranced the American public, Jean-Paul Ryan Francis Enrique was just another young offshoot of Jamaica's famous Enriquez clan, one of the oldest Jewish families on the island, who immigrated there from Portugal in the 17th century. Paul, who has British and Chinese heritage on his mother's side, actually grew up Catholic in a solidly respectable uptown Kingston, watching the raucous parties thrown at his grandmother's home by an enterprising aunt who ran a sound system. Kingston is a city that takes parties seriously, and the sound system was a key 20th century innovation, a portable setup of amplifiers, turntables, and mountains of speakers, all orchestrated by a DJ and an MC, who trucked the equipment to makeshift venues and use its booming sound to draw crowds. Paul and his younger brother Jason were both enamored of this family business. Jason actually recalls falling asleep in a bass box as a child. It was both brothers' earliest immersion in music, listening to the uptown crowds dance to Michael Jackson beats blended with the dance hall and reggae rhythms of Kingston. Despite the legacy Paul was born into, his childhood was shaped by absences, like that of his father, Garth, who would disappear for months at a time, leaving his wife, Frances, hunting door to door, asking neighbors if they had seen him. He would materialize months later, perhaps having whiled away the time in Mexico, once having crashed a Cherokee 6-plane stuffed full of marijuana in the Everglades. When Paul was 13, his father was convicted of manslaughter and sentenced to 15 years in prison. This devastated Paul, not because his father had been much of a presence in his life, but because what little he had of him would now be gone. It felt, he says, like, that's forever. Oh, I'll never see this dude again. His mother sent him to Walmer's Boys School, among the oldest in Jamaica. Paul, who until then had been a bit of a dreamer, was thrust into a teenage milieu far removed from his former Jewish prep school. He began getting in fights with kids who teased him about his father being in prison. He was saved from a descent into hooliganism by swimming, a sport for which the Enriquez family is well known. Both of Paul's parents were champion swimmers, and he carried on that legacy, representing Jamaica at international competitions and as a water polo player, his days beginning at 5:30 a.m. and spent training furiously. Still, his grades weren't good enough to get him into college, which was beyond his mother's means anyway. He enrolled in a program for hotel management and learned the basics of French cuisine. Yes, Jean-Paul of temperature fame knows how to make hollandaise. For a while, he worked as a bank teller while making demo tapes in private. He would freestyle with a group called the Duddy Cup Crew. And there was a time when his father, newly released from prison, tried to introduce him to people in the music industry. But watching Sean, thoughtfully introspective Sean, pursue a career as an MC and dance hall toaster still seemed outlandish to those around him. He recalls a well-intentioned friend getting drunk at a party and crying while asking him why he was throwing his life away. The real hitch in his early career wasn't his demeanor, it was the subjects he wanted to write about. The young Jean-Paul was intensely affected by the differences he saw in the quality of life between uptown and downtown Kingston. The early songs he wrote or of a subgenre classified as conscious reggae, socially minded stuff, meant to highlight the injustices he saw around him. He didn't see any trouble with this until a producer took him aside and told him flat out, no one wanted to listen to conscious songs from a light-skinned uptown kid. He might have had a father in prison for manslaughter and a mother who, he says, did tie-dye to support the family. And he might have grown up occasionally eating Kalaloo picked from the backyard. But on paper, he was a posh boy with a surname and family legacy that made it impossible for him to be taken seriously while singing about wealth inequality. Crestfallen, but persuaded, Paul pivoted, channeling his sensitivities into the topics producers wanted him to sing about, parties, women, and weed. One result was Baby Girl, a stripped-down track in which Paul entreats a woman to dry her eyes, leave her no good man, and come to him, a man who will love you for your body, but more for your brain. To him, Paul says, this was still a conscious song. In dance hall, you always sing big of the ladies, how good they look, or about wanting to get with them. But you never sing about, I hear you're in trouble. You're in a relationship where you're being abused. I'll be there for you. That's what the song was about. In dance hall, masculinity is often a kind of balloon animal the MC inflates and twists into aggrandized shapes. In her book, Dance Hall, Origins, History, Future, the professor Donna P. Hope identifies the six G's lyrics tend to dwell on. Gun, guile, ghetto, gaze, ganja, God, and how each can be used to underline the vocalist's machismo. The genre had made inroads into the U.S. market before from Supercat, Shabba Ranks, Benny Mann, Inni Camus. But if Paul would one day top them all, perhaps it's because even at the peak of his party boy persona, he understood that longing for things you cannot have is a universal sentiment. He spent his entire career writing soft-focused love songs and ballads of unrequited yearning. They're just disguised as songs to grind pelvises to. Temperature promises to shelter you from the storm. Rockabye is an earnest tribute to single mothers. On Give It Up to Me, he promises, love so clear, it's gonna make you shine, and once you are mine, we'll be rocking it until the end of time. These are club tracks, but if you, just hypothetically, happen to be listening to them on repeat during your fifth hour of silently hiccup sobbing into a pillow, don't ask, they would absolutely deliver in that arena as well. Baby Girl was Paul's first local radio hit, earning him some popularity in Jamaica and paving the way for his first U.S. studio album. But it was his sophomore LP, Duddy Rock, that made Sean Paul into the commercial Leviathan he is today. 2002, a brief New York Times article noted an interesting new record featuring 19 songs by different artists, all built on the same bewitching rhythm. A basic beat for dancehall artists to record over, created by a producer named Stephen Lenky Marsden. The Diwali rhythm, named after the Hindu festival, was built on frenetic syncopated hand claps that escalate over an underlying boom. At the time, Marsden had no sense of the classic he had created, but if you were alive in the early 2000s, you simply could not escape the contagious sound of this percussive loop, which would bounce and undulate its way through the culture everywhere. From Lumidee's charming off-key hit, Never Leave You, Uh-Oh, Uh-Oh, to Wayne Wonder's No Letting Go. Marsden received a phone call from VP Records asking if he would lend the rhythm to one of their buzzy new artists, Jean-Paul. The result was Get Busy, a monstrous hit that transformed Paul's career and helped sell nearly 6 million copies of Duddy Rock. Back in the clubs, cars, and Cristal era of R&B, The Get Busy music video was an anomaly too, depicting a party that would be recognizable to suburban diasporas everywhere. Adults gathered around a dining table, young people crowding the unfinished basement below, an angry Caribbean dad in a loud batik print shirt yelling at the youths to stop banging on the damn furnace. Paul is now closer to the age of that video dad than the basement party starter he played. In the intervening years, he's remained booked and busy, ushering in a steady procession of hit songs, both his own and collaborations with other pop stars. Whether you have recognized it or not, a new song of his has likely made its way to you in the past 8 years, perhaps by way of No Lie, his collaboration with a sandpapered voice, pre-fame Dua Lipa, his work with the actor Idris Elba on the rambunctious Boasty, or his guest feature on Sia's Cheap Thrills, which seemed to blare constantly from the stock exchange size H&M in Times Square in the summer of 2017. Paul may now be an elder statesman of dance hall, but he's still producing, recording, and performing with vigor. As for the Jody in Get Busy, she's now his wife. I am one of those millennials who discovered Jean Paul at age 12, but I also grew up in a secluded, almost cult-like boarding school in India, where we were forbidden any sort of internet access and had little idea what was popular among people our age in the outside world. My only familiarity with reggae was by way of an English guy named Stephen Capper, who grew dreadlocks, called himself Apache Indian, and sang in a Punjabi-inflected patois about wanting an arranged marriage with a dainty Indian girl who would make him rotis. I did recognize the Diwali rhythm, but only because the Lumidee hit based on it would play with Megan Fox's character when Megan Fox's character appeared on screen in the Lindsay Lohan classic Confessions of a Teenage Drama Queen. Still, somehow, by way of some entrepreneurial soul who knew how to burn a pirated music onto CD, Get Busy would play on repeat at my all-girls school's gatherings with boys from a neighborhood school where chaperones were stationed at every corner to prevent anyone from getting even remotely busy. Whether it's at a grimy nightclub or at an auditorium full of emotionally stunted teenagers avoiding eye contact in Dehradun, India, there are a few things likely to occur whenever a DJ puts on Get Busy for a crowd of the right age. There will be squeals of recognition as Paul booms, "Shake that thing," each word with its vertiginous pause. Then the delirious, almost incantatory hand claps will start to register. "It's the ignition of those butterflies," he told me, as Paul's exuberant melodies combine with the boisterous throb of the Diwali rhythm, listeners' hips and waists acquire a sentience of their own, moving as if threatened to secede from the rest of the body. This was true in 2003. Some 40-year-olds, I asked wistfully, confirmed this for me. And it remains true. 2 decades later, I watched Paul live in concert. Not once, but twice, last year in New York. He was a consummate showman, with unflagging reserves of energy, leaping around in front of the giant Jamaican flag draped over the DJ console, overseen by his brother. Paul seemed to know exactly who his audience was, and to this audience he gave exactly what we wanted, his biggest hits, opening immediately with the iconic intro of Get Busy, to which we all lost our minds. On both occasions, I witnessed elder millennials try hip movements far beyond our joints' collagen levels. Each time, I felt as though I had been factory reset as a person. The members of Paul's preteen fandom, whether that means me in 2003 or the kids browsing TikTok a year later, might not have had any frame of reference for the parties and spliffs that he was singing about, the Jamaican patois he was singing in, or his place in the lineage of dancehall. But a thumping party track is a thumping party track. And not knowing the lyrics would not stop any of us from, as one recent video elegantly put it, throwing ass to his bangers then or now. For decades, Paul has offered the service so much great pop does, distilling a mythical idea of the perfect party, the always pumping club, and delivering it into the minds and ears of people who will not learn for years that real club going tends to be much more tedious and involve uncomfortable shoes. For someone like me, someone who, until I moved away from home, wasn't even allowed to go to parties, let alone parties with sexually suggestive dancing, Paul's songs were about the poetry and promise of dark, sweaty basements and libidinous gyrations. Neither was part of my life at 12, and neither are part of it as a not-so-young anymore adult with an office job. But Paul's best songs take all your amorphous longings and feelings of exile, whether imposed by a pandemic or boarding school or a lost youth, and exorcise them. I can't wait for the weekend. I can't want to see that girl again. That, Paul told me in Kingston, is the type of anticipation he puts into his songs. Because if there's one thing he's understood since he was 14, it's the stultifying restlessness that lurks beneath the lives of suburban teenagers. Today, he considers it his artistic purpose to exalt uncomplicated ease and pleasure. His legacy is the pure euphoria that erupts on faces when he performs Get Busy. The fact that he has been doing this for more than 20 years struck him recently when he realized that the nieces and nephews, who were infants when the song took off, are now old enough to drink and party and experience their uncle's concerts. And then they start going to the shows, he giggled. And they're like, yo. At 22, he said, he had wanted to sing about social evils. At 50, he's found peace simply taking people's minds off them. And now I'll read from the Screenland section of the magazine. What is Welcome to Wrexham doing to soccer? Hollywood has turned a perfectly good fourth-tier Welsh team into a TV show instead. That can't be great. This is a story by Amos Barshit. Last month, the Welsh soccer club Wrexham AFC embarked on a buoyant tour of America that it called the Wrexham USA Invasion Summer 23. The team packed stadiums from North Carolina to Southern California. It played against the mega clubs Chelsea and Manchester United. Its ticket holders enjoyed fan zones equipped with bustling merch stands and cardboard cutouts of Wrexham personalities, even a pop-up version of the Turf Hotel, a pub in the actual Wrexham, a city of 135,000 in the north of Wales. One popular activity was taking selfies with Wayne Jones, the Turf Hotel's publican, a touring member of the Summer Jolly. Wrexham is a place with the familiar Rust Belt trajectory, mill and mine closures, job losses, economic desperation. Before the season that began this month, its team played in the National League, the fifth tier of English soccer, a universe away from Chelsea and the top-flight Premier League. The National League still includes a few teams that aren't fully professional. Typical attendance at Wrexham's racecourse ground used to be less than 5,000 a game. In Chapel Hill, the team played in front of more than 50,000. The reason for the changes, of course, the FX docuseries Welcome to Wrexham. In 2021, the actors Ryan Reynolds and Rob McElhenney bought the club and set about changing its fortunes on camera. During the pandemic, the British actor Humphrey Kerr had given McElhenney a a viewing recommendation. Sunderland Till I Die, a docuseries about the decline of another soccer club in a post-industrial town. McElhenney loved it, and as Kerr told The Athletic, formulated a plan to tell the same story in reverse. Buy a struggling football team and turn it into a competitor. He wanted to reverse engineer a feel-good sports documentary. He would also end up satisfying America's love of underdog stories set in quaintly hard-up corners of Britain, like The Full Monty, recently revived as an FX series, and creating an odd real-life analog for the hugely popular Ted Lasso. The reverse engineering project has clearly been a success. The show, with its portrait of the tight-knit community surrounding the club, attracted a devoted enough audience that sales of the club's jersey spiked wildly. The team dropped its previous front-of-shirt sponsor, a Welsh trailer company, in favor of TikTok. Wrexham matches, which even in Britain would have been considered obscure, can now play on ESPN. It's the real underdog thing, one fan of the USA invasion told the Evening Standard. It was an underdog thing. Since taking over, McElhenney and Reynolds have stocked Wrexham's roster with players who are, frankly, too good to be playing in the National League. Paul Mullen, for instance, is a striker whose copious goal scoring helped get Cambridge United promoted a league. He instead jumped two tiers down to join Wrexham. He was injured during the USA invasion and stayed in the country to recuperate in McElhenney's Los Angeles home. Last season, the four highest paid players in the National League all played for Wrexham. At the season's end, the club was promoted to League Two, the fourth tier of English soccer, for the first time since 2008. In the days that followed, Wayne Jones had to shut down the Turf Hotel. Despite his best efforts to prepare, he ran out of alcohol. When the show's second season begins in September, streaming on Disney Plus, it's a safe bet that every episode will be seen by far more people than will fill the racehorse ground for a whole season's worth of Wrexham matches. 2021, the sale of a different soccer club made international news. Saudi Arabia's public investment fund took a controlling interest in Newcastle United, a competitor in the Premier League. Unlike Wrexham's story, which has been treated as a kind of homespun pushback to a world in which private equity billions slosh around and sport teams are used as state propaganda, the Saudi purchase was castigated internationally as a new nadir in professional sports capitulation to the richest entity in the room. The head of Amnesty International UK bashed the league for allowing those implicated in serious human rights violations to walk into English football simply because they have deep pockets. Reynolds and McElhenney don't represent an autocratic petrostate and are implicated in no human rights violations, but the two takeovers do have one thing in common. Both the actors and the Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund are operating in spaces where their wealth distorts everything around them. Long-time Wrexham supporters are certainly delighted by the team's successes, but they must also recognize that the club has become something new and different. Both an athletic behemoth and a pop culture one. It's not just that the roster is full of what are effectively ringers, being paid situationally outlandish amounts from what I can't help imagining are the profits of the Deadpool franchise. Reynolds and McElhenney have created an Ouroboros in which TV funnels fans and money to the team, leading to successes that in turn create more TV. It's a clever gambit for endless expansion, but also one that, as the club's U.S. tour underlined, risks turning Wrexham into more of a media project than a soccer team. It also feels directly opposed to the communitarian values that ostensibly made Reynolds and McElhinney interested in the team in the first place. For a decade before their arrival, Wrexham had been a community club owned by a coalition of fans called the Wrexham Supporters Trust. One of the club's former board members, Spencer Harris, posted online this spring to take issue with the title of a BBC program about the club, Wrexham, Hollywood or Bust, and its suggestion that without the actors, Wrexham was doomed. 4,000 supporters, trust members, took over an insolvent business, he wrote, turned it around, and handed it over with cash in the bank after a global pandemic. The trust didn't even profit off the sale. In the interest of helping the club's prospects, members essentially gave the team to Reynolds and McElhinney in exchange for a guarantee that they would add £2 million to the budget. That fan base now shares its connection to the team with all those who will binge-watch Welcome to Wrexham and feel their own sense of ownership, and with the actors who sometimes overtake the club's identity entirely. One recent headline assessed the team's prospects like this. Ryan Reynolds and Rob McElhinney are on track for the League 2 points record. As a new television season begins, it will surely become untenable for Welcome to Wrexham to ignore its own impact on the club it's documenting. For what it's worth, English football is full of less complicated tales of resiliency. Luton Town, for instance, is a small club from just outside London. The team's nickname is the Hatters. Their home ground, Kenilworth Road, has its modest entrance stitched through a row of terraced houses. While not self-owned, its ownership consortium is made up of local fans who willingly ceded a small share and a set of veto rights to the Luton Town Supporters Trust. At its lowest ebb, the club played in the fifth tier. Doesn't spend a lot of money because it doesn't have a lot of money. But the team has scouted well and hired good coaches, and this coming season, having won its way up the ranks, it will compete in the Premier League. Someone should make a documentary about that. Or, honestly, maybe they shouldn't. Now I'll read a letter of recommendation. The Secret to Unshakable Confidence. Face your fears and take the plunge. You'll feel freshly confident after you do. This is a story by Haley Howey. I don't remember a time without diving boards in my life. I've always loved them. This affection doesn't extend to heights in general. I'm not interested in jumping off the tallest, most treacherous cliff or platform. I'm talking about a very specific joy that comes from launching your body off a springboard. Bouncy things bring out a playful, childlike quality in some people. I dare you to jump off a diving board angry. It's impossible. I live in Austin, which means that a pool is crucial to surviving the Texas heat. I prefer to spend at least 3 or 4 days a week in the natural waters of Barton Springs, the legendary public pool. I've been diving there since I was a kid. My mom was a Barton Springs lifeguard when she was pregnant with me, and still there's the tiniest, almost undetectable tinge of fear every time I make my approach. My go-to move is a pike dive. It goes like this. Right foot, left foot, skip, bounce, feet together, hips up, head down, hands to toes, legs straight above my head, and whoosh. All of a sudden, I feel weightless as the water rushes past my ears and I'm surging into the depths where no one can see me. I keep coming back for the alchemy of exhilaration, fear, and confidence that turns into pride, calm, and relief as my body enters the water. I've met so many people in line at the board. I see them weekly here at our collective happy place. On any given day, I might run into Linda, who goes by the nickname Lady Go Diver, with a swimsuit doing one of her signature tricks, like the twirling mermaid, which involves putting water in her mouth and doing a 360 while spitting it out. It's rare that I don't see at least one of the Marks, whom I met about 2 years ago and who are named for the order in which I met them. Mark I is a sweetheart and easy to spot with his white hair and fading tattoos, a classic Austin look. We're having a competition this summer to see who can nail a 1.5 front flip first. Loser buys enchiladas. Mark II is a security architect and triathlete. He's a celebrity at this board, one of the best divers I've ever seen. He lands double backflips like it's nothing. It's truly incredible to watch. As soon as he shows up, people flock to him for advice on fine-tuning their tricks. But it's not just experienced divers catapulting themselves off this plank. On a busy summer day at the Springs, the line might be 30 people deep and consists of all kinds of thrill seekers, experienced divers and novices alike. It's not uncommon to see 4- and 5-year-olds inching their way to the end of the board. When they finally do jump, the crowd of onlookers erupts as if the home team scored a winning touchdown in overtime. If it's a busy day at the pool, my dive might get a reaction too. Sometimes the audience will clap or even gasp. When I come up for air, I might hear a stranger say, "Did you see that?" as if they're surprised to see a plus-size woman in her mid-30s perform this gracefully. But the reaction is just a bonus because the dive is not for them, it's for me. It's proof, that if nothing else, I've still got this. You see, I haven't always had the kindest relationship with my body. I've never been small, which means that for most of my life, small is all I wanted to be. Finding clothes that I feel good in, especially in the sweltering heat of a Texas summer, is a challenge every year. But I've always felt safe in a bathing suit, because even when I hate my body, the pool is neutral ground. No matter what kind of day I'm having, what my body has or hasn't accomplished, I can still dive. Confidence can be a tricky thing to hold on to, which is why I started to panic when I started seeing diving boards less and less. First time I noticed the trend was in 2011, when I heard that my small hometown outside Austin was renovating the public pool where I spent my childhood summers. A massive upgrade was planned for the original pool built in the 50s. Word around town was that they were replacing the board with a slide, and not even a cool slide. Looks like something from Toys R Us, kind of cheap plastic contraption that might be fun the first time you play with it, but inevitably ends up at the bottom of the toy box. A few years later, when I moved to Oakland in 2015, it took me nearly 5 years of searching before I found a public diving board. When I finally saw one at the West Campus Pool in Berkeley, my eyes began to water. I spent the next 3 hours blissfully diving, feeling the release of years of built-up tension. Once I started talking about the disappearance of diving boards, everyone had a story for me. Mark, too, told me that when he was road-tripping around America, he searched for boards in every town he visited. There were few and far between. When he found one in San Diego at a Jewish community center, he was devastated to learn that their rules prohibited any fancy dives or flips. As far as I can tell, this is all to do with insurance and liability. Municipalities don't want to pay higher insurance rates that come with diving boards or get sued for any injuries. But to me, a pool without a diving board is like a theater without a stage. Without diving boards, where will we go to be brave and show off and believe in one another? So if you see a diving board this summer, I encourage you to take the plunge. Who knows how much longer we'll be able to? Haley Howey is a writer, editor, and podcast producer based in Austin, Texas. Previously, she was a senior producer at Pop-Up Magazine. And I'll read the Screenland section, another one. what I saw when I looked inside my own body. Modern medicine is constantly showing us our guts and bones. Why doesn't it feel more profound? This is a story by B.D. McClay. It wasn't that I thought medical imaging was simple, precisely. I understood that a real human body is complicated, that the anatomy textbooks were the map, not the territory. I understood that the plastic dummy with its removable organs was a model, not an exact representation, that the brightly colored images hanging in the doctor's office were not photographs, that the episode of the magic school bus, in which the class travels through Arnold's digestive system, was not a documentary. Still, what I didn't anticipate was that when confronted with an image of my own body, the product of the rotating series of X-rays known as a CT scan, I wouldn't recognize it at all. I don't mean as myself, but as anything. For most of human history, there was only one way to see inside the body. You cut it open. When in 1628, William Harvey published De Mortu Cordis, his theory of the circulation of blood, he relied on vivisections of dogs and sheep. To produce the detailed anatomical drawings in Gray's Anatomy, Henry Van Dyke Carter relied on human cadavers. It wasn't until 1895 that a physicist named Wilhelm Röntgen tried something new. He put the hand of his wife, Anna, between a cathode ray tube and a photographic plate. There it was, her skeletal hand. Anna was revolted. "I am seeing my own death," she is said to have screamed. In Thomas Mann's novel, The Magic Mountain, set a decade or so later, the tubercular Hans Castorp, too, saw his own grave in the X-ray, the flesh in which he moved decomposed, expunged, dissolved into airy nothingness. I am the beneficiary of more than a century of acclimation to the idea of seeing inside yourself. The X-ray, along with all the imaging technologies that followed, is one of the modern medicine's routine little miracles, just like insulin, penicillin, vaccines, and effective pain treatment. We see inside bodies all the time now. On TV, doctors examine X-rays and ultrasounds for clues. On social media, grainy, fetal-shaped floating in the void tells us that a friend is pregnant. A trip to the dentist yields the alien side of your jaw flattened out and hung up for display. From my CT scan, I expected a brush with mortality, the opportunity to see the forbidden land of my own guts, to contemplate their eventual decomposition. By that point, I had already had an organ removed, my gallbladder, and I suppose I expected to register its absence somehow. What I saw instead was just shades of gray and blobs of darkness. Nothing was recognizable as an organ. At one point, I remember the doctor directed me to pay attention to something that, in his own words, didn't look like anything at all. That, he wanted me to know, was my pancreas. He was right. Didn't look like anything at all. If for Anna Röntgen and Hans Castorp, the X-ray produced something that was undeniably and terrifyingly their own body, I was having the opposite experience. Whose body was this? Was it a body at all? Without the doctor there to tell me what it was I saw, I would have never known. In popular culture, medical imaging represents a simple statement of fact, a question resolving into certainty. Watch episodes of the medical drama House MD, and you'll see imaging confidently used to diagnose psychopathy, to tell whether someone is lying, even to visualize the subconscious. People lie and bodies deceive, but tests and scans don't. And so in the real world, one submits to these devices nervously, as one would to some kind of truth serum or all-seeing eye. There's no hiding here. Even when we imagine a superhero with X-ray vision, we imagine somebody who sees through the inessential to the essential. in a scene in the 1978 Superman. The Man of Steel flirts with Lois Lane first by scolding her for smoking, then by scanning her for lung cancer. Her lungs glow pinkly and cutely for a moment before he informs her that she's all clear. Later, at her request, he tells her the color of her underwear. Like his super strength, Superman's X-ray vision is allied to his virtuous nature. His eyes tell the truth and can't be fooled. Nobody expects strict medical accuracy from superhero movies, but popular science narratives are hardly more cautious. We are often breathlessly informed, for instance, that parts of the brain light up when presented with certain stimuli, telling us precisely what people are thinking, feeling, and why. Of course, parts of the brain don't light up at all, only their images on a fMRI indicating blood flow. Even in everyday life, medical images convey an official certainty that's hard to obtain through other means. I've known friends to forego different parts of the medical process throughout pregnancies, but the pregnancy announcing sonogram is de rigueur. Without that image to show friends, you simply aren't pregnant, socially speaking. You just might be. For medical professionals, though, all these imaging techniques are imperfect tools, just another way to get a partial idea of what might be happening inside a human body. You have to be trained to read them at all. The doctors on house run and pore over scans themselves, but in reality, both creating and interpreting CT scans are specialized jobs. Radiology can be subjective. Not as subjective, say, as art criticism, but not cut and dried. In the future, artificial intelligence may take a greater role in interpreting results, but it won't make the experience any less alienating if, instead of depending on human expertise to analyze your body, a computer program is making judgments and flagging risks based on patterns and correlations even the doctors may not be able to see. All we want from a picture is reality. All we ever get is representation. From medicine, we want pure science. But what we get is a complicated tangle of guesswork and certainty, tried and true and trial and error. You can undergo countless tests without reaching clarity. Even when doctors have identified the main problem, when their ability to operate and repair feels truly godlike, there remains the things they simply don't know. Doesn't look human, the picture on the screen. I've watched professionals use ultrasound to search my arms for veins, looking for spots of black in a field of dark gray, and then plunging a needle into a promising spot. Yet it never quite felt as though it was my arm over there on the screen. It's as if I had another, more real body that could be glimpsed only temporarily through arcane practices into which I had no insight. What I wanted from a CT scan was a particular kind of self-knowledge, even if it was just an understanding of how my organs look packed together. What a relief it would have been to confront something as certain and solid as my own grave on the computer screen. Instead, I saw the only thing I'll ever see in any picture, a mass of shapes that might mean something and might mean nothing at all. Sometime after I underwent surgery, the surgeon showed me photographs of the procedure itself. Like the CT scan, the photographs were chaotic and confusing, but they were at least fleshy. I saved some, thinking I might be interested in them later. Months later, scrolling through my pictures, I ran across some thumbnails of uninteresting heaps of meat. What's that, I wondered. And why had I saved these boring and frankly slightly disgusting images? Then I remembered. It was me. And now I'll read a letter to the ethicist. My father was abusive. Should I attend his memorial service? The magazine's ethicist columnist on what to do when a toxic parent passes away. And the reader writes, I am the adult child of an explosive, intolerant, narcissistic father who found gratification in his harsh treatment of me throughout my childhood and adolescence. I was terrified by his beatings and constant bellowing. Over time, he settled into an easy contempt for me. Although I witnessed him abuse my siblings too, my father focused his abuse on me, his firstborn. He died a few months ago. In his final years, I emerged from estrangement to help my siblings understand his complicated medical situations. In his final months, he admitted his enduring cruel treatment of me to his sister and one of my siblings. After years of denying and justifying his abuse, he left his last recorded words in a voicemail message to me saying, I'll never get over my struggle to apologize to you. My father was financially generous, supporting our education, homes, and families. My siblings catered to him until the end, and now they're organizing a memorial to him for the children. As the memorial approaches, a sibling of mine expressed concern that I would be triggered and upset the children. My father's prim, octogenarian sister cautioned me against attending, seemingly more out of fear of my presence than concern for my well-being. These family members fear the truth of my experience, which would threaten their facade and their denial of his cruelty, which is all in service to the decorum of a good family. I'm grateful for the love and support of my wife and children, and I want to be present with them for the memorial. Attending the memorial to witness the lore and mythology will help my understanding of the family. How do I be present with my wife and children at my family's loyal memorial to my abusive father? How can an abuser be honored or memorialized? The silence about child abuse is deafening. And Anthony Appiah writes, sounds as if part of what distresses you about the coming ceremony is that your relatives haven't fully acknowledged the reality of what you experienced. You can't mend your relationships with the rest of your father's family while they treat your anger rather than his abuse as the problem. This will have to be addressed if you want decent relationships with them. But I doubt you'll be able to see that right at the memorial. Set that right at the memorial. You're speaking out about abuse will, your account suggests, be taken as reflecting badly, not on your father, but on you. I would show up all the same, if you can bear to. There's a good chance that you would, as you say, learn illuminating things about the family and their perspectives, and so would your wife and children. You might also consider writing an account of what happened to you, mentioning that your father accepted at the end that he had wronged you and sending it to your wider family. What you have to report will surely come as news to some of them. Others may come to see what happened was worse than they allowed themselves to acknowledge. A few may even take on board a dark history that they had minimized and express their sympathy. However, people respond, you will have found your own way of memorializing a complicated and disturbing truth. And we'll end with Judge John Hodgman on texting from the bathroom. A married couple confronts a strong taboo. Linda writes, my husband Pete texted me a gif of a cat riding a unicorn this morning. This was fine, but he sent it when I knew he was in the bathroom. He says that's fine. I disagree. Help him realize I am correct. You didn't marry an idea of Pete or Pete's brain in a jar. You married a whole farting, sweating, leaking, burping, beautiful human being just like you. But the bathroom taboo is strong. Like most mammals, we seem to have a hardwired instinct to relieve ourselves in secret, to hide the indignity, vulnerability, and the smell of that moment from both predators and loved ones. Or maybe I'm just thinking of cats. In any case, I agree the bathroom door must demarcate a cognitive dissonance zone, the portal to an alternate dimension each partner does the other the favor of ignoring. If there are cats riding unicorns in that world, only Pete can see them. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine. My name is Bill McCann.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aincolorado.org or by calling 303-786-7777.